Welcome to episode 47 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Howard and Catherine Clark of Twin Rocker Handmade Paper, a legendary papermaking studio in Brookston, Indiana. We talk about how the two of them met in graduate school at Wayne State University in Detroit, cleaning silk screens. How sweet. And how they were introduced to papermaking by Aris Catrulis, a Tamarin-trained printer who was exposed to paper by Lawrence Barker, who was also in Detroit teaching at Cranbrook. Kathy says she thought there were papermaking studios everywhere, since there were two in Detroit at the time. After graduate school, they moved to San Francisco, where Kathy was the first woman to print at a Tamarind offshoot shop. Howard, who studied mechanical engineering and industrial design, started building equipment, and Twin Rocker was born. Eventually, the couple moved to Brookston, Indiana, to a family farm, and the business grew over time, creating some of the finest papers in America, and collaborating with numerous artists and selling papermaking supplies. Howie tells me how one of their key mentors in developing fine papers, because they were some of the few doing this at the time, was old books and old prints. They learned a lot from looking at the paper in old books. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Howie and Kathy Clark, welcome to Paper Talk. We're here in Brookston, Indiana, in your home, and we've just been to Twin Rocker, a legend. And I'm super excited to hear your story. So I wanted to start with your beginnings. You two met in college?
Yeah, we met in graduate school.
Grad school, okay.
Right, and I was getting a master's in printmaking, and Howie was getting a second degree in industrial design.
And where was this?
At Wayne State University in Detroit. And
I just got out of the Army, and Kathy had just gotten out of undergrad school.
We actually made paper in the printmaking class at Wayne State.
Okay.
Lawrence Barker was teaching at Cranbrook,
right,
which is also in northern part of Detroit. He had become interested in handmade paper with Doug, because he had heard about this eccentric named Douglas Howe, who lived out on Long Island and who was supposedly making paper. And so Larry Barker went out there for a very short period of time. He became interested in making paper, and so he went back to Cranbrook and tried to make paper in the closet. Mm-hmm. So he got a little valley beater, had a standing press, a bookbinding standing press that is a screw press,
right,
to be able to press the water out in a vat, and he knew almost nothing about paper making, except when you have cloth or cellulose and water and you beat them together, you get paper pulp. And when you make it into some kind of a sheet form, you have paper.
Right.
And so at that moment, at the very same time, there was the first Tamarind master printer that decided they really wanted to teach. So in Los Angeles, Tamarind Studio, the Tamarind Workshop, was instrumental in reviving fine art lithography, limited edition prints, and teaching those master printers to start professional studios. So they were teaching them how to run a business as well as how to print lithographs and work collaboratively with famous artists who, all of them, were not printmakers. So the artists had to be either painters or sculptors. They couldn't already know printmaking.
Okay, yeah.
And
because they wanted to push the medium in different
They wanted to get prints into museums.
And what year was this about?
Well, Tamarind was a $1 million Ford Foundation grant that lasted for 10 years, and it went from 1962 to 1972. And I was the first woman to print in a Tamarind offshoot shop.
Oh.
But that's when I went to San Francisco after we left Detroit. Aris Catrulis was the only master printer that decided to teach. He wanted to teach instead of starting a professional studio.
Okay.
And as he said, you know, those printers had to swear in a lithograph stone that they would never teach. But he decided to teach, and he went to Cranbrook because he had to have a master's. Tamarind intentionally did not give any kind of master's degree or anything like that because they didn't want them to teach.
Okay.
So he went to Cranbrook to get a master's, and it was right at the time that Larry Barker was interested in spending his time in the closet making paper. Mm-hmm. And he had this guy who knew much more about printing lithographs than he did come as a student. And so Aris taught lithography. And at that time, Walt, just maybe your listeners aren't going to know these names, but some book arts people would.
Sure.
At that same time, Walter Hamady was a student, and Winifred Lutz.
Okay.
So he had one incredible typographer, letterpress printer in Walter Hamady. He had an amazing sculptor in Winifred Lutz. And then Aris, Wayne State University, said, "We have a blank check. Come down Woodward Avenue about 15 miles and make the studio of your dreams."
Wow.
And so Aris said, "Great, okay, I will." And so when he started teaching lithography at Wayne State University, and it was the best lithography teacher in the United States you could learn from, he also wanted to have paper making in that same studio.
Oh, okay.
Since so, he'd seen it at
Cranbrook. Yeah, Cranbrook. They had, you know, we had a little vat. We made paper from old rags that we collected. And so it was all very thready and color, you know, it was whatever color the rags were.
Right. And what were you beating it in?
And a little valley beater, because these laboratory beaters were very available since nobody wanted, you know, nobody knew about making paper by hand. I assumed that this very rudimentary, crude paper that we might be making was probably being done in every printmaking studio in America. I had no idea that this was the only place, because Cranbrook was doing it and Wayne State was doing it, and that's two schools in one city.
Right.
So I figured it was everywhere.
Right.
I didn't know it was nowhere except there. Then I met Howie, you know, when he was there studying.
We met cleaning silk screens
together. Isn't that romantic?
Yeah.
And his first degree is in mechanical engineering from Purdue University.
Okay.
So he was a mechanical engineer, industrial designer.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the little valley beater, the laboratory beater, maybe once. I never thought I would make paper again in my life. I mean, it wasn't something I liked particularly. I thought it was wet and heavy, and you know, we didn't have any control. You know, so the whole notion of that Larry Barker and Aris and everybody and Douglas Howell wanted to say was that craftsmen or the artist can control the image from the paper itself, that the image can begin in the paper. And Douglas Howell, his main contribution was not craftsmanship, but it was the idea that the image begins in the paper. The philosophy of it, that white rectangle is the image, is the first image that a printmaker sees, that a person doing a drawing sees. And there's no reason why it can't be a red circle or a blue triangle, you know, or something else, an uneven shape.
And I think Douglas, or Lawrence, says that Douglas let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah.
So he started experimenting with a red circle and these things that you're
saying. Right, so that whole notion, and Douglas Howell got it from being in the occupation after World War II in Japan. So he saw hand paper making in Japan and using colored pulps there, and so that inspired him. It, you know, everything comes from something else.
Yes,
you know, you have an experience somewhere. And so then Douglas Howell brought that whole notion of the image beginning in the paper itself back from Japan, and Aris Katrilis was the first person that was going to want to print on a handmade paper and have part of the image in the paper. And this was 1966, 67, 68. Okay. So I started graduate school in 66.
Okay, okay.
And 66 to 69.
Right.
And then Howie and I moved to San Francisco in 69.
And what precipitated?
And Twin Rocker started, and then I got a job printing for a Tamarind offshoot shop, one of those master printers that had started a shop in San Francisco called Collector's Press.
We went to California because a friend of mine, a neighbor, when I was at Purdue, started a business out there, and he called me because it was like a high-tech thing. It was all computer stuff, which was new those days. He knew that I could do artwork as well as understand the technical part. So
you moved for your job?
Yeah, we moved for his job.
Yeah, there wasn't a job yet. And I said, we were coming out, and he said, wait, you know, I just started this thing. And but we were finished with Wayne, and so...
Right.
So we took off in our sports car and camped out all the way and had a wonderful time. Drove all the way to California, and then I found a job doing engineering. And
I started printing lithographs.
And whose shop was it?
It was called Collector's Press. It doesn't exist anymore. Uh-huh. And Ernest DeSoto was the master printer there, who was a Tamarind printer, right.
Okay.
So the people who really influenced us were not only Ernie was very important, but Clifford Burke, so a very wonderful letterpress printer who wrote the book Printing Poetry that had became a sort of iconic thing with letterpress and book designer, letterpress printers and book designers. He was a friend of ours in San Francisco, and he's the one who realized that there wasn't any handmade paper being made in the United States. There was no professional studio of any kind. So, and people who wanted to print letterpress, find limited edition books, had to import English or European handmade papers.
And the problem was there was a place in New York, Andrews Nelson Whitehead, which was an importer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very good, but getting it all the way to the West Coast was another story.
Oh,
you know?
Okay. So it was a supply and demand issue.
They just didn't like it. Yeah,
couldn't get it.
Uh-huh. Well, almost nobody in the United States had ever seen handmade paper.
Right.
You know, at that time. People in San Francisco, Andrew Hoyam had, Clifford Berg had, Grabhorns had. I mean, you know,
There was a lot of interest in letterpress printing on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some great printers.
There was very high quality printing. And so the cream of the crop, the best letterpress printers that went to all extremes to make the most beautiful books, they knew what handmade paper was.
And they knew because they had looked at old prints, or had they been to Europe?
Because of old books.
Looked at old books.
They had looked at old books, and they imported, you know. Right. So Andrew Hoyam had already printed Howl, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, on English handmade paper.
Okay, right.
But they had an awful time getting it.
Clifford Burke said, you should start making paper, because he said, Howie can build the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of scale we needed to make paper on didn't exist. Right. So there were the little laboratory Hollander beaters, the ones that Wayne State University used. They were beating 1 pound or 3/4 of a pound of fiber at a time, which was way, way too small. And then the industrial size was way, way too big.
Right.
So there wasn't any equipment, and the main piece of equipment you need to have is the Hollander beater. So Clifford said, well, you know, Howard can... He's an engineer.
That.
He should be able to build that, you know. You
got, plus, I built stuff.
Yes, he's very good with his hands, and he's an artist, too. So then, you know, it's like, well, okay, Catherine, you know, you're the craftsman, and you can make the paper, and Howie can build all the equipment. No, it'll be that easy, And I'm going, no, we can't do that. No. And Clifford says, don't question, just accept. And so this became the thing. It was like, don't question, just accept. We were excited about trying something that hadn't been done before.
But there was a market for it, too.
But there was a recession
happened
in the aerospace.
Uh-huh.
And
we didn't know how
to make people. So I was out of a job. One Saturday we were in a Sears parking lot, and we're selling attachment to a hand drill to work like a drill press. So built a beater. Plus we knew Ron, the McDonald's that made the press.
Ron Terrazas.
Yeah.
Was building, wrote the big rollers. When I was printing, some of the technology that was just being developed to print limited edition lithographs well, and one of them is that Ron Terrazas in Oakland had developed the first big rollers to be able to lay down a whole flat of color. And so the prototypes for these rollers were really heavy. And he brought them to our shop, of course, across the bay. So we were experimenting and printing with these huge rollers that were maybe, you know, I don't know what's that, 12 inches in diameter.
Wow.
Yeah. I'd say, at least 12, maybe more.
Yeah, maybe more.
Okay, so Twin Rocker was born in San Francisco?
Yes.
And tell me where the name comes from.
Well, the name comes from my printer's chop. There's two embossed marks in the corners of the print. One of them is the mark of the publisher, and these are called chops, C-H-O-P.
Okay. Yeah.
So one of them is the chop of the publisher of the print. The other is the printer. There was a tradition established at Tamarind, so this is all sort of how Tamarind decided to
document prints. Provenance. Mm-hmm.
So the printer's chop is usually designed from the printer's initials. And my initials are KC. Mm-hmm. And so my printer's chop was a K from the side, you know, from a K on top of a C. Okay. And so it looked like a rocking chair from the side.
Uh-huh.
Because Kathy likes to rock, too.
Uh-huh. And so then when we were just starting, well, another thing is that really irked me is when I was printing is that we always printed on machine mold-made paper, which is machine-made paper, not that so much as the watermark would read backwards because it would say the name, you know, watermarks are always the name of the paper mill.
Right.
And there's two sides to every sheet of paper, no matter if it's machine-made or handmade. One side is the wire side, which is where the pulp falls on as it's being formed. And the other side is the felt side, which carries the paper onto its next section of paper being pressed in the press. The watermark always reads more clearly from the wire side because the wire that forms that ARCHES or BFK
is on the
wire, is attached to the wire. The wire side of the paper is not the best side to print on.
Oh, okay. The felt side.
The felt side is the best side of the paper to use for printing. So when
only a printmaker would know that there's a very slight grid on that.
So if you're printing, if I was printing a large flat color in lithography on the wire side, there's a chance that the little grid of that mesh from the wire would show if there wasn't very much ink on that.
So it's smoother on the back.
So on the felt side, it was smoother. But I felt like I was going to make a symmetrical watermark that would read the same from either side of the sheet. So because it didn't matter and what side an artist used. Okay. It didn't matter what side that an artist or a letterpress printer or anybody could use either side of the sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Only the world out there thinks there's a right side and a wrong side because of the way the watermark reads.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why Twin Rocker has a symmetrical watermark, and I have a twin sister. So we named it Twin Rocker because I just designed the watermark and the logo, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
And so it was a back-to-back rocking chair. Two K's back to back on top of a C, basically, is what it is.
And we're also looking. One of the things we admired about Tamarind is that it didn't mean anything in particular. It wasn't like saying Tamarind Mills or Tamarind Printing or Tamarind Publishing or like it. And so Twin Rocker was also a nice anonymous thing. It didn't right. identify us as a, if we didn't say we were a paper mill, it sounds like
right.
belching right. smoke and acid, you know. Mm-hmm. But we were just a studio, so.
Okay, so you built equipment mm-hmm. and you started making paper
in our basement, in San Francisco? Right. So I was print, this is really, it was just a wonderful serendipitous opportunity. I mean, it's why does something happen? Mm-hmm. You know, we're important pioneers in this whole crap. Mm-hmm. So many things fell into place time-wise. I happened to be printing. Then I'm printing 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. So when I was printing at Collector's Press, this was the height of the
rebirth
of fine art lithography. And there were big markets for it. Mm-hmm. Museums were starting to buy collections. Corporations right. were having collections. It was, you know, so the editions that we were printing were close to 100. Mm-hmm. And in addition, mm-hmm. I was printing 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. So I wasn't doing any papermaking. In our basement in San Francisco, my brother-in-law, Kit, and Howie, and Peggy, we're making paper. My sister Peg.
Peggy's your sister.
Yeah. And they were making paper, and then I would take it to Collector's Press, and I would print mm-hmm. on it along with Arsh and BFK or whatever I was doing the edition, so I could test it.
Right.
So I could say, you know, does this perform? And mm-hmm. Twinmarker has always been interested in making papers that are useful, been making papers that perform well. As opposed to, say, decorative papers like papers from Thailand or something,
right.
you know.
Right.
Or doing a reenactment just to show that paper can be made by hand. We decided that there was a function for handmade paper, mm-hmm. an aesthetic function that was entirely valid with the modern day art.
Right. So how did you recreate the craft of hand paper making? I mean, you'd done it in school, but...
Well, no, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
right.
Barely. We really did everything wrong. I mean, there was... you know, children in grade school can make paper, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
sort of like I'm trying to explain to people, you know, if you carve an eraser and you stamp
printing,
it,
yeah.
you know, that's printmaking.
Yeah.
That's printmaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can be that mm-hmm. crude and simple,
mm-hmm.
or it can be extremely complicated, beautiful, limited edition prints.
But
paper making is the same way.
The mm-hmm. other thing that you know? Ernie DeSoto did is we asked him if he would be interested in it, and he said, well, if you can make paper that I'll print on,
uh-huh.
I'll buy it from you.
Right.
So.
Right. So we made one order, one very important order, of paper for Collector's Press for Ernie DeSoto, and it was a suite of lithographs by Jose Luis Cuevas, a very wonderful Mexican artist, and the suite was called Cuevas Comedies,
mm-hmm.
and the paper was all 22 by 30 white,
mm.
And so, you know, this was just not the whole edition. There was a main edition, and then there was a special edition. In the special edition, which I don't know how many copies it was, but that was what was on our paper in the special edition.
Okay.
And so that was the first, that was the beginning. In a sense, because I was printing in a shop that printed limited edition prints, our notion was to make paper in limited editions for places that were like Collector's Press.
Right.
And to make a paper that did have part of the imagery in the paper, possibly, that could be a shape, any mm-hmm. shape, that could mm-hmm. make, they could be circles, they could be triangles.
Mm-hmm.
But they could also just be exactly what was needed, the color and the shape.
Yes,
and the size.
That's right.
Right.
And so we've always been committed to not just making paper that couldn't be repeated,
mm-hmm.
but to make paper whether it's on a custom basis or in a stocked basis that performs well and can be repeated as much as it needs to for the edition, because many times we're talking about a limited edition book. It could be, you know, if
something happens,
thousands. It could be thousands of sheets that need to be almost, you know, as close to possible, the same thickness. Yeah. So the letterpress printer,
right?
You know, looks good.
Yeah. Right.
And things like that.
We had our mentor was old books and old prints. And we learned a lot from looking at them, like the difference in paper between a portrait and a landscape and that sort of thing.
Woven laid, surfaces. Right. And
The thing is, in the old days, they're printing, they expected the paper to be more variable. Uh-huh. In fact, you see a lot of old books where there's four or five different kinds of paper in the book.
Right.
Because everything was limited by the fact that everything was made by hand.
Uh-huh.
But modern day printers printed on machine made paper, so.
Right.
So we had to make paper that would.
Well, handmade, yeah. So
our handmade printers. Paper had to print like machine made paper. So.
Right, to sell them on it.
Well,
because that's what they were used to.
Yeah, right.
And the people looking at the books, too, are more critical of the printers. So, you know, everything, the printers expect paper that's going to print well and make them look good. And people are used to looking at good letterpress printing where the impression is the same on each page of the book. And, you know, hundreds of years ago in Europe or in the United States when they had the paper mills, the hand mills, were more crude, and they were loft drawing every sheet of paper and then calendaring it to get it to be fairly smooth. Mm-hmm. And there were foldovers and bubbles and
junk in the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, really all kinds of flaws.
Did you build all the equipment for that studio then? You made molds and
decorations? Well, we borrowed a press.
Yeah, we borrowed a
bookbinding press.
You built a beater.
You built the beater and mold. And made the first mold out of redwood. I thought, well, you know, it'll last. But discovered that the red color is water soluble. Uh-huh. So you put it in a vat, and the vat
turned
pink.
Turned red, yes, pink. Yeah, that mold didn't last long.
And where were you sourcing your fiber?
Okay, they were all old rags.
Uh-huh.
We got them from a
hospital. Yeah. Well, they're rag suppliers.
Uh-huh.
But they were mainly wiping rags, and they're from hospitals. Now, so in San Francisco, all the paper we made was from rag sources that was 100% cotton, white. White cotton.
Mm-hmm. But we wondered how they... It was really hard to make anything but lithograph paper there, you know, which needs to be absorbent. But making text paper was something that we weren't able to do.
The first paper we made in San Francisco was pretty soft because it was made from old rags.
Right.
And then not until we got to Indiana and, you know, built other things and built the whole studio, the building, that we started to discover other sources of rag. So we, you know,
we also found some historical references that the best paper was made from new rag cuttings.
Right.
So tell me about the transition then. What year did you move to Indiana?
In 72.
And it was because
spring of 72 because
inherited.
Howie's dad died.
Okay.
And Howie's grandmother, his father's mother, had just turned 80. She was living alone on this little tiny farm, 20-acre farm that that had been purchased with her grandfather's Civil War pension. Mm. And she grew up on this farm and lived there with her grandparents and her parents. Grew up, she married. She had one son, one child, and after her husband died, she moved back to the farm and continued to live with her mother there. And her mother lived to be 92 or something.
92.
Mm-hmm. And then she lived alone for about 10 years, and then her only son died. Mm-hmm. And we were living in San Francisco, so really Howard needed to, you know, we needed to think about the farm. And
it was only part of it. We also figured out in San Francisco that that was not the place to try to make paper because it was too expensive to live there.
Brookston, Indiana is where this farm was, where you are now.
Right. You can see it out.
I can see it out the window.
Yeah.
So you packed up, moved.
We brought the Hollander beater here that Howie had built. That was the important thing. We knew we had borrowed this bookbinding press that we were using. It was a large nipping press, actually, for people who understand those terms, that would just barely hold a 22. Well, actually, it didn't. I mean, a 22 by 30 sticking out. Just, it almost fit.
How were you drawing paper in San Francisco?
We were...
Had a silkscreen drying rack.
Yeah, that's right. We were laying it on screens on a silkscreen drying rack.
Okay.
Why it worked, I had no idea. When we got back here, it didn't work.
Did you press them in again after they were dry to kind of flatten
them out?
And then they were printed on going through presses.
They were printed
on. So you had... You knew you were...
And they were soft. They were softer.
Right. That's
so
right.
They didn't cockle as much as later on if you're using new rag.
Right. And so you knew you were moving Twin Rocker.
We were moving Twin Rocker, yes. And we had...
It was an interesting thing. Part of the reason we started making paper was that there's an annual show that's held in the park area right in front of City Hall in San Francisco. In those days, I don't know if it's still
a fair. It's like an art fair.
Yeah, and Kathy was working as a printer already, and she printed on some of the paper she made in Detroit when she was at Wayne State. One of those prints was in the show. After we got started, we said, "Can we have a booth there? Because we're going to have paper for sale." And they said, "Well, they didn't have art suppliers have booths because." They tend to be, you know, big time outfits like Grumbacher that would sort of take over an area. And but they said, we do have this art in action thing that we... And there's a printmaking workshop that would have
a
booth there,
so
and they would print stuff.
Uh-huh.
So we were on the opposite side of the divider, and actually during the fair, we would hand paper underneath, and it was already damp because it hadn't dried yet.
Oh.
And they would print it.
Uh-huh.
So, but it turned out that I built the beater, and we're trying to make the right kind of pulp out of it. And hadn't really figured it out yet. We just had figured out, we'd finally made a batch of pulp we could use when it was time to set up for the show, so we put the beater on somebody's truck and took it down there. So we actually hadn't made any paper yet. And then we got there, we were going to use water out of the reflecting pond.
Okay.
But somebody put a dye marker in it. So I put a waste basket in one of those little carts that you use for shopping, for grocery shopping in the city, you know, that two-wheel cart. I went over to the city hall and went in through the basement door to the bathroom and filled it up with water and brought it back a bunch of times. And blasé San Franciscans would sort of glance at it like,
"What's he doing?
What are you doing?" You know. But eventually found a guy from the parks who provided us with a hose that they use for watering the grass. So we finally got a batch of pulp made and put it in the vat, and it was Kit and I were the only ones there.
And my brother-in-law.
How were you, how did the beater run outside?
They had power. No, we had power.
Yeah, oh, you said he made pulp.
Okay. Oh, you made pulp.
After we got there,
we
plugged it in, they had power there for us. So we finished the batch and put it in a beater and went and got some more water and diluted it. And there was a whole, about 50 people standing there when they made the first sheet of paper.
Wow.
They didn't tell them that was their first sheet of paper.
I said, "The kit, it works."
Oh, that's my goodness. This will go down Kathy, in history. Kathy, now, nobody yeah. knows this. I mean, this is not that it was a secret, but I think that's the first time we've ever told it. This is the very beginning story. The very first sheet of paper a Twin Rocker ever made was made in front of 50 people at the San Francisco Art Fair.
How we said it worked.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Year, a new monthly planner that is now for sale. Hooray! You can find it at bit.ly/12monthsofpaper. That's bit.ly/TWELVE months of paper. I'm rebranding the 12 Months of Paper calendar, a how-to book and calendar featuring a paper project every month, which I've produced for the past 3 years. The Paper Year is a wire-bound book still featuring 12 paper projects by me and 5 guest artists, and this year there's an added feature, a planner page a month, which allows you to jot down notes and plans, sketch out your ideas and dreams, and paste in swatches of the paper you use to create your projects. Get one for yourself and shop early for the holidays. Again, you can find that at bit.ly/12monthsofpaper. Spell out the word 12. Now back to the show.
But right before we left San Francisco, we met this, I don't want to go on and on about,
well,
you know, we did.
Well, what I was going to say, what happened from that show is that a guy who ran a museum in the valley at on just the other side of Oakland, Walnut Creek,
yeah. Okay.
And a great art center in an old walnut mm-hmm. warehouse. And so he said, you know, I have a deal that I pick a show out from this show, but nothing I really like, but I really like what you're doing. Can you bring it over and do it in the gallery as a...
As a show?
Yeah.
Making paper?
So we brought the whole mm-hmm. works over to Walnut Creek. Oh. And for a month, we made paper there and did and gave talks and stuff. And people came from
all over
the state to...
People came, the printers. Best people, the best calligraphers, people came from Los Angeles
wow.
to see this show, and to because the word got out that we were making paper, and it was so unusual.
Uh-huh.
And so we met, we already knew exactly the day we were going to leave. We were, the end of the month that the
right.
show was over, the U-Haul truck was going to come and take us away.
Right.
I mean, and it was so exciting and so sad because we met... really important calligraphers, bookbinders, mm-hmm. letterpress printers from all mm-hmm. over California, conservators.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were so excited that somebody was, of course, they thought we were learning how to make paper, okay?
Right.
And good paper.
Yeah.
You know. But they were so excited that there was an American papermaker. It was so important to us because mm-hmm. when we got to Indiana and it was this big void.
Yeah.
There was nothing
right.
here.
Right.
There was nobody to encourage us. There was nobody to say, this is important what you're doing.
Right.
But we had the memories of these people
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That were saying, oh, don't quit, you know, keep
right.
going.
Right.
We really, America needs a hand paper maker.
Met an important conservator, and Stella Patrick, who had been she'd worked at the Florence Flood. And she told us about conservation, about what was going on, what they were discovering.
The need for new papers.
Right about that time, they were discovering that everything in the Library of Congress was going to be bad in 20
right.
years if they didn't do something about
okay.
it.
Right.
And
so the Florence Floods was was like a world war of bookbinding.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was when they really just started to realize that the pH, of paper was important.
Right.
That the neutral pH was important, that it was good for paper to be alkaline if it could
mm-hmm.
in some way. They started to look at old papers and compare them with the modern papers that were falling apart.
And seeing why. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Stella was... So some of these people were very important to us. And Stella Patry, as a bookbinder, that told us how important the pH of the paper was, the quality of the light fastness and coloring agents, you know, all of the...
Which had also been a concern of the Dameron workshop,
Anyway, so then we moved to Indiana.
Yeah.
We built, the barn was too dirty to make paper in.
Too small.
It was too small. We realized we were going to have to do something. So we, who had never built a chair or a table before, built
I built a lot of stuff in every building.
Yeah.
I built the table.
Oh, sorry. so we built this 24 by 48 foot building, and Howie was, our leader, and he and Kit and I did most of it.
So did Kit and Peggy move here too?
They moved here too. So they were supposed to be, you know, part of this whole thing, but they didn't stay.
Okay.
And
well, their marriage broke up.
So. Yeah, their marriage broke up, and they left. It went, you know. But so we started building the mill in the summer of 72, and it took us 6 months.
We started
in January of 73 to actually make paper.
West Coast, or who were you making for?
We didn't know how to make paper yet.
Okay,
so you have to realize.
Still...
But
once we...
Yes, we did have,
But we'd figured out a lot of stuff by then. By January. January is when we made our first sellable paper. One of our first customers was Jack Lemon at Landfall Press in Chicago.
Okay.
And,
so the word, we never approached,
in
50 years, we almost never looked for,
we
have no idea how to do a
market.
Cold call. we didn't know how to market. We still don't know how to market. But, so the word was out, you know, when there's only one paper maker, in America, and you have... All these Tamarind printers knew each other.
Yeah.
So they knew.
When
Jack Lemon
in San Francisco, Tamarind was still in operation for when we were in San Francisco.
Yeah, it didn't end until 72.
And when Jasmine was printing, they would come up because they heard there was a woman printing. And she had actually
applied. They weren't allowed. Women were not allowed to apply to be a master printer at Tamarind.
And so what were you?
I was a printer, but I wasn't at Tamarind.
Oh, you
I was at Collector's Press.
That's right.
But Tamarind was still in Los Angeles.
Okay.
It was still going on there.
Got it.
And so those guys, when they were in the Bay Area, they'd come by to see what I looked like. Because they basically... Tamarind was run by June Wayne, who was... She had her problems, but she, you know, she had a... It was her idea for Tamarind, and it was... A lot of wonderful ideas, so I don't, you know. However, the image she wanted to project, part of her mission to get limited edition lithographs into museum collections and things like that, was to have these macho men be the printers. And so she did not want any women. And as the men said, you know, she was the only miniskirt at Tamarind. But they women could go there, and they would teach them to be curators, which were people who numbered the prints and put tissue on them and would, in a sense, work for museums and corporate collections to collect and store prints. Those were all women. But all of the printers were men. But I was lucky because Eris Catrullis, who I learned from, never told us that women weren't allowed. I didn't know that. I might not have gone and applied for the job at Collector's Press if I had known that women wouldn't be accepted.
Interesting. Wow.
Right.
Okay, so let's speed along.
Yeah.
I know you guys have a long history. But
we do. And we're just at the
beginning. I know. Maybe.
So one of the things that happened, too, is that we knew that we still had things to work out, like light fast colors and stuff. So Kathy Kathy got a job teaching at Purdue. Through the head of the department, he said that, you know, there's the one thing that in this country, it was hard to get loans for things like what we were doing. But that was the function of a grant, to do things that haven't been done before, because banks don't loan on something that hasn't been done before. So they gave us a small starter grant, to help you, what do you call it, to get a grant
going. A seed grant, too.
So we went to New York and to Washington, D.C. That was real important.
We talked to the National Endowment for the Arts, and
They didn't have a program for us yet, but they did have... We did talk to a library materials outfit that had funded some research into conservation. And they told us about what they were, from a funding standpoint, what they were interested in, which helped a lot with writing a grant.
So we couldn't expect our customers, we couldn't expect Landfall Press to fund experiment testing of light, of colored papers to find out how light fast they were, when his competitor Gemini GEL in Los Angeles or Ken Tyler in New York were his competitors. And so, you know, we couldn't expect one customer to do this. And we're taxpayers, so we're not nonprofit, and we can't apply for grants. So I was teaching one class part-time, you know, so two afternoons a week I'm bringing in some money, teaching printmaking at Purdue. And we found out that we could get a small grant, that they would give us a small grant as seed money, then we applied to National Endowment for the Arts, but we weren't capable of applying because we're not nonprofit. So we had to go through Purdue Research Foundation and jump through all their hoops, and then they also take 50% of the money just to be able to use, you know, to go through them and be able to apply.
And stuff that we didn't use.
So we did, and it was a matching grant, and we had no money to match it with, and we didn't know anybody that we could do this with, and so, but I happened to, one of my students at Purdue was an older person, I mean, which was unusual to have somebody that wasn't a college student. And he happened to be a lawyer, and he happened to be a lawyer in a very, one of the most well-known, prestigious law firms in the state of Indiana. His partner had been governor, and so he knew that he suggested that the Lilly Endowment match this money. He said the Lilly Endowment funds exactly what you're doing in other countries. They just don't fund it in this country. And so he said he doesn't see any reason why they shouldn't fund it in this country, and especially in Indiana, when Lilly is an Indiana endowment. And so we asked them to match the money, and then we got the grant to do the testing of, and we used Purdue's fadometers in their, that they normally would use for testing the color of cloth with dyes. But we could up it, you know, so we tested paper to 100 hours in a carbon arc fadometer, which is what currency was being tested to. So we figured that's what our
standard
should be. And so that's the only grant we ever applied for.
We got two.
The other thing that we did, and you asked about this too, are the apprentices.
I thought that was funded.
It wasn't funded.
No, it wasn't funded.
But later, so I'm just going to jump forward because when we carefully wrote out this budget when we were applying for this grant. You know, exactly, we need money for this much money, this much money, this much money. And we had this budget that we thought was really well thought out. Lilly Endowment matched it. They were going to match the grant. The National Endowment for the Arts just gave us a round figure of money, more mm-hmm. money than we asked for.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had asked the National Endowment for an apprenticeship grant, but they didn't have an apprenticeship program.
Mm-hmm.
And but they, in a sense, when we asked them for this money, they said, well, we don't have an apprenticeship program, but that's a really good idea.
Oh.
And so then when they gave us more money than we wanted, we informed them that they had funded their first apprenticeship program.
Oh.
And then we used that extra money that we got for the apprentice that were here. We'd already had two, so they actually funded Tim Payne and
Tim Barrett.
And was
Tim
the...
Barrett. So it must be after Tim was here.
Did you get the idea of the apprentice from Tamarind, sort of? No.
No, the idea came, they didn't have apprentices.
No, we didn't ask.
Yeah, they were.
What happened was that on that first trip in California, when we visited everybody,
mm-hmm.
we visited the University of Southern California, and...
we gave a lecture at USC.
There was a woman there that got excited about it, and... She was going to come out and she wanted to come make paper with us.
So we've never initiated anything.
Oh, and we said, no, you don't want to do this. We don't have any money. And
yeah.
So, but she came anyway.
Okay.
And that's how the apprenticeship program
came. That's how it started. So Kathy Kitty.
We'd also met Tim Barrett. Tim Barrett went to Yellow Springs.
Antioch
College in Ohio.
Yeah.
And they had a work-study thing.
Okay.
And so he was on the West Coast.
In San Francisco on this work-study.
And that's where we met Tim.
Okay.
And he was
heard,
back
he
at...
Heard, he, were, he heard... He was interested... I don't... We'll see. He is from Michigan, his family.
Yeah.
Kalamazoo.
Right.
And he had gone to Cranbrook as the... It's a private high school, boys' school.
Right. He went for high school.
So he went for high school at Cranbrook. And Larry Barker was probably... You remember,
yeah.
Larry Barker is probably making paper in the uh-huh. closet, you know, uh-huh. and meanwhile at Tamarind, and you know, at Cranbrook. And so then Tim went to Antioch to college, and he was kind of interested in this paper-making thing he didn't know much about. Then he goes to he goes to San Francisco on this work study. He hears about us making these
paper.
Crazy people making paper in their basement. He comes to our house to see that,
mm-hmm.
and then we end up going back to Indiana. Kathy Kitty has heard this, our lecture at USC. She writes to us and wants to learn.
Right.
We're telling both these people, we don't know what, you know, we're still learning.
Yeah.
We don't know. But basically we said, well, you know, if you want to, if we can't
pay you,
we don't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to learn with us, you know, we're still learning. You're welcome to come, but you know, we can't guarantee you anything. You can stay here on the farm with
uh-huh.
us. And so they did. They both came, and we didn't say we wanted to have apprentices or interns or anything. We didn't even know what that was.
Right.
We had no clue. After Kathy and Tim were at Twin Rocker, then we thought, well, this is really important. It's a great idea.
So we put it in with a grant, like you Kathy said.
And then the next, Antoinette Dwan, who then became a conservator, she was an apprentice when we were doing all this testing of
mm-hmm.
colors and
mm-hmm.
in dyes, both dyes and pigments.
Mm-hmm.
And
also
Lee McDonald.
Lee McDonald came in.
Yeah, so he was in that second group too. And I'm not sure exactly when the money came. Maybe they were the ones that got some of that supposed, you know,
right,
apprenticeship money
right.
from the National Endowment. That was the only money we ever got.
Right.
It wasn't continuing or anything. We didn't apply again. We weren't.
It was a lot of money.
Right.
We were not nonprofit.
We yeah.
couldn't
yeah.
even apply.
Right.
But we also couldn't get a bank loan. So.
Right.
So but it was significant. It was $50,000.
Yeah.
And. That got us through all that, and it was just amazing. Within very short order, we were making paper for Rauschenberg. You know, we and that trip out to
New York
and D.C.
Yeah,
we met Tanya Grossman because of a conservator who introduced us.
Mm-hmm.
And
so, did you make paper for her? ULA.
Yes. Many. many years.
Okay.
And also, we wanted to see the watercolor collection, I think, at the Museum of Modern Art. And so we called to make an appointment, and the curator, famous curator.
You're Riva Castleman. We just sort of tried to make an appointment, and they said, well, what, you know, what's your name and everything. We gave our names, and then all of a sudden the curator comes down to see us, and she says, oh, Catherine Howard Clark from Indiana. Oh, well, of course you can come in, right? And we're going like, we're sort of like looking back, you know, is she talking to somebody else, you know? It's like our very first trip to New York City, we know nobody.
And they know, and,
she knew, you know, because this is how,
yeah.
And before the internet, computers, I mean,
but it was because
word of mouth
yeah.
is amazing.
Because we made some paper for
Jim Dine.
Yeah, we made some paper for Jim Dine for Jack Lemmon. And typical thing.
Well, the biggest paper,
let me tell that story. Jack said, how big a sheet of paper can you make? I said, well, I'd build a press that's 3x4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
He says, good, make me some. Because Jim Dine's coming and I want to do some paper for him.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to make a mold.
Right.
You know, a big mold.
36x48.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember that Kathy Kitty had quite an extensive record collection. It was still vinyl in those days.
Uh-huh.
And we listened to the whole thing while we sewed that mold together.
Oh, my goodness.
And,
yeah.
And we made a dozen sheets.
Uh-huh.
Took them up to Jack, and they proofed on them, and everything looked fine. So then we got an order to make paper for him.
100 sheets he wanted.
Yeah. And
oh, my gosh.
The next sheet we made did not dry flat.
Uh-huh.
The first paper we dried, we didn't have anything to dry it on, so we just laid it on top of the mold. The only thing that was big enough was the mold itself, and it dried completely flat. I mean, it was just a miracle, you know.
Nothing dried flat from then on.
Nothing dried flat for months.
Well, and you had to make 100 sheets?
Yeah, we had this order. But so fortunately Dime went out of the country, and we had some time. And
yeah, Jim Dine, he was having a show in London, England, and Jack said, you know, it's okay. You know, he's out of the country now, and we have another month or something, mm-hmm. you know. So, and we just tried everything. I mean, it was, but anyway, so some through many machinations of one nightmare after another.
But the thing is, when we
the paper made,
when we got to New York and D.C., they knew we were coming. You know, it was mm-hmm. pretty amazing.
Right, right.
And in very short order, we made paper for all these famous artists.
And you must have built more equipment, and I know you have a 15-pound beater now, but for like 100 sheets of 36x48, that's a lot of pulp.
Yeah.
So did you make a big beater pretty early?
No,
or the beater you were just beating a lot of pulp?
The beater I built in
after all the other, you know, when he started Twin Rocker Equipment Company and started making the white beaters, you know, the small Hollanders for other people, that I still was using the
very first
old
one.
Yeah. And
which was about an 8-pound beater, so it wasn't
Yeah, it wasn't a tiny beater, but it was a small. Yeah, it was about, I don't remember.
I think it was about 8 pounds.
I don't think it was 8 pounds.
Well, it was eventually. I kept messing with it till.
But
so let's go back to the apprenticeship. How long did that go on?
12 years. So
12 years.
So we decided that the mission of the apprentices was to be there for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and
go forth.
We would, you know, that we would not kick them out. We would live with them for 2 years. They would live, which was really wonderful because we, through whatever personality, we got through getting
mm-hmm.
to know each other and getting to work and finding out what people could, how they could contribute. And their mission was to go out and to contribute to the field.
Right.
So there was not like, you need to do this or you need to do that. No, people could do whatever they wanted. And many of them went abroad.
Mm-hmm.
So Susan Hostetler went to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Payne went to Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Barrett went to Japan. Sashka Ross went to France.
Well, yeah. Other people contributed in other ways. Lee McDonald's
started selling tools. Yeah, and then people came back. I mean, everybody came back here. yes, that's right. Lee McDonald started making equipment and other things for people. So he, you know, he became an important supplier because part of our mission from the very beginning was to help revive handmade paper in America. So, right. So there are 12 apprentices. It went on for 12 years. And we were going to end it before that, but then the last two people that came, one of them was a wonderful calligrapher, Janet Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And one thing I said to her is, well, you're a calligrapher. You're not going to become a papermaker. Why, mm-hmm. you know, you shouldn't be able to apply this. And she we went, wait a second, you know, she's a fabulous calligrapher. We could be learning calligraphy from her while we're teaching her papermaking. And so we took these two Janets.
Uh-huh.
Janet Hughes and Janet Lawrence were the last two.
We had a lot of double names.
Yeah, that's right.
And what about printing? Like, I know Barb Tettenbaum was a letterpress
printer. Well, so she was a letterpress printer. So that was a unique situation.
She was a special case,
was a special case because...
she came to set up her print shop because
we had
a press that we brought back from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we brought back a very large Vandercook from San Francisco that we got from the San Francisco Chronicle. But then we also bought a wonderful letterpress from a company, Typo, in Indianapolis that was also a Vandercook, a very useful size. But I didn't have time to get it going, you know, and I felt like when you put something in place and it's happening, then you just continue to use it. The momentum is going. And so Walter Hamady had asked us to come up and jury a show at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and Barb was his graduate student that was his preferred person, I guess. And so she's the one who picked us up at the airport, and she hosted us, and she took us around and all that stuff. And then after we left, she wrote us a letter and said, can I be an apprentice? And we already had two, so I said, well, we have this letterpress we just acquired, and we have a little shed for it and everything, and it'd be nice if you could be our printer in residence and use it and use the handmade paper and learn something about hand paper making along with it, but, you know, use the letterpress. So that's, and she was here for 3 years, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to know when you started selling equipment, and then not only equipment, what do you call everything else?
Supplies. Yeah.
Supplies.
As soon as we started making paper in Indiana, we immediately started getting letters, a few letters from school teachers saying, can I make paper in the classroom? I want to make paper in the classroom. I want to make paper with my Girl Scouts, you know, something. And so we had the supplies we were using.
Right.
And we wanted to help them out so that they could make paper in the classroom. And it wasn't that we said we wanted to sell supplies. I mean, we didn't know.
Just kind of evolved.
It just evolved. I mean, first it started out as one sheet of paper, I think, or something. You know, we didn't... The big vision that we had was that we wanted to help revive papermaking in America.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know how to do it. We had no background or experience in business.
But we also had no, we were dumb about business, but we hadn't run our own business.
No, but one of the reasons that we were successful, I think, was because we knew nothing about business.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's some logic to it.
Right. And what about, like, figuring out how much to charge? Were you just kind of keeping in line with what other people were paying for paper? I mean...
No.
What you're selling a sheet of paper for is cheap when it's a Jim Dine print or, you know what I mean?
Well, right, exactly.
But for you, you're the ones making
a living. But it's not just for Jim Dine.
Right.
No, that's the thing. It's the same paper for Joe Schmo.
Right.
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 And, and Joe Schmo doesn't, his print is not as valuable as Jim Dine's.
Right.
So we've always, and we still do, compare the price of machine-made paper. You go like, okay, well, what's the alternative?
Right.
You know, our competitor is Arshin Reeves and German etching. It's a mold made, machine made paper.
Right. And then the stationery end. You do a lot of smaller sizes. How did that develop?
Okay, well, I think that, you know, one thing that is important to say is that we live in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have any walk in traffic. Right. We've always specialized in making custom paper, consequently, that perform for customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we also make stocked papers because we have time to do that. So we try to have both. We try to have stocked papers that in watercolor and, you know, but the fancy invitations.
Ellen's question was about stationery, and I think actually it was because of a designer who wanted some invitations for her kid's wedding.
Okay.
And I think that's how we got started. And of course, we could, you know, we could make it. So.
So you made that, and then you had the setup for that, it just kind of. I was just talking to a friend yesterday who's a painter, and I said, "I'm going to Twin Rucker," and she's like, "Oh, Twin Rucker! I used to buy their paper." And you sell it around the country in retail
stores?
We said
we used to.
Oh, you used to.
We used to, and then finally, we felt like, well, there was a good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing about doing that is that they, Twin Rucker's name and hopefully our logo, basically give you advertising.
Right.
For that, you lose 50%.
Right.
You know, and basically you're giving them the paper free.
Yeah, right.
So you lose all your profit for whatever advertising is just your name in a catalog. So that's bad. The good thing is that you get advertising. The bad thing is that, one is that every retailer would buy different sizes. We make a huge number of different sizes and shapes. And each retailer would purchase maybe 6 different sizes.
Right.
And rough and cold pressed or whatever. They might purchase different sizes. Some of them were the same. People out in the world then thought that's all we made. They didn't think that, you know, because they're used to machine-made paper, which would be made 22 by 30. They have, you know, hundreds of thousands of sheets in their warehouse or whatever, and it's unending, and there's only the one size or maybe 2 sizes or something. After we started selling handmade paper in different sizes, other machine mills started coming out with smaller sizes and more sizes. It was like because they felt like they had to compete with us.
Oh, goodness.
Can you imagine?
No.
And that was a negative.
Yeah.
And so about 2 years ago, Travis Becker, when I retired, so Travis Becker took over.
Right.
And he started working for me when he was 20 years old. And now he's in his 40s.
Right, okay.
He's the one who said, you know, it just doesn't make sense anymore. Yeah. People know about Twin Rucker.
They can order from us.
They can order directly, And there's other small retailers that supply, that make art supplies and other things like canvas and things for painters that only sell direct. And people want to, they want to purchase from the paper maker.
Small business,
you know, they, and they like to have direct contact with us.
New York Central was different because it was staffed by artists.
Right.
And they really knew paper.
And they carried your paper.
Yeah.
They carried it.
But now, they also knew that we had other sizes and stuff.
Right.
And so if a customer wanted other, they'd either get it from us or they'd tell the customer to call us.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So, yeah. They were great.
Good. Yeah.
So, there's a store in New York City that does sell paper. Just, and New York Central All Supply in New York used to purchase overs and things like that when we would have a limited number of sheets that were left over as first from a custom order. They would snap those up and then have that limited number, you know, in their store, which they loved.
Yeah.
Now there's another store that does that. And there might be another one in the future.
Okay.
But that's all. So we're really out of the catalogs now.
Right. Right. Okay, and you mentioned Travis a couple of times now.
He walked in the door one day, and he always hated school, and uh-huh. he's extremely bright,
uh-huh.
A wonderful athlete,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he was just perfect. Yeah.
He told me once, he said, you know, it was such a good jock that I was able to get out of geometry. And he went... Yeah. But he's figured all that out himself. He's really a great guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, I only had to, you know, whatever I when I was teaching him, I only had to tell him once.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. But
he's got a lot of good ideas.
Yeah.
And so he runs the shop now.
Right.
How many employees
are there? There's two. There's always been two paper makers.
Two paper makers, okay.
And there's two other people.
Mm-hmm. Filling orders.
In the back, filling orders, inspecting paper.
Uh-huh.
And now as a retired person and as an old paper maker, I'm doing what all old hand paper makers have always done through the hundreds of years, and that is to go back into the mill and inspect paper and sort paper and... Then on the invitations, I'm hand scoring, folding, and gluing, uh-huh. and doing all the things that are not at the wet end.
Right.
You know, and that's what old papermakers have always done.
Right.
Yeah.
And we didn't mention, we should just say, so you were on the farm for 13 years, did you say? And then you moved into town.
Well, it took us 5 years.
To
build this building,
okay.
Yes. It's an old International Harvester dealership
uh-huh.
building in downtown Brookston, but which we completely remodeled.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took, because we were doing it ourselves, mm-hmm. except for the cement being poured, how he did everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, except for that floor.
Right.
So it took us 5 years to slowly get one room done. And the last one to be finished was the actual papermaking room, because we could still make paper on the farm.
Okay,
so we were, the office moved first.
Right.
And then
the
back area where we were storing paper, we didn't have enough room on the farm to store paper that we wanted to. We needed to expand. And then we were sorting paper and inspecting paper in downtown and wrapping paper. And UPS would come to the downtown building. And
wow.
we would have to, so once the paper was dry, it would go downtown.
Mm-hmm.
All the paper, the making was happening on the farm.
Right.
I was driving back and forth twice a day or at least, whatever.
Mm-hmm. What's like an average number of sheets that are produced?
Most of the paper we make is 22 by 30 because it is the biggest convenient size for
one person
to mm-hmm. make. And that's why it was always made that way in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty heavy. I tried that at Dudonné a couple times, and that was just... I can go up to 18 by 24. I didn't...
Oh, really? Well, we make 23 by 32.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these letterpress printers, these book printers, it's just like going there going, you have to fold it. You know, I have to cut off a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm going, 22 by 30. Oh, I really need 23 by 30.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I really need 22 by 32.
Wow.
So, yeah, we do.
And
but also, when you make it every day, there's you learn how to do that.
Right.
And we had people that were athletes
uh-huh.
really helped, because we had a guy who was a very good papermaker, but he couldn't dance. You know,
uh-huh.
I mean, he was a, and so the other movements were awkward and he was slow.
Well, I was the main paper maker for most of the years.
Yeah,
most of the years, all the way up until we hired, because when it was Travis and me, so Travis Becker and I were the two paper makers.
Right.
And, you know, at that time, Travis was beating pulp and making paper as well. So
mm-hmm.
I was making, you know, a post of paper is however many sheets are going to put in the press, but it was usually 50.
Mm-hmm.
So I was making 3 posts a day.
Okay.
And
we
then he would make 1 post a day or 2 posts a day.
I figured with 22 by 30, we could make about 200 sheets a day. I remember it was a...
And you talked, before we talked on the podcast, a little bit about loft drying at the farm.
Uh-huh.
So you still are doing a little bit of transporting
all, papers. Yeah. So when we're drying, we can loft dry paper also at the mill downtown, mm-hmm. but not nearly as much. So when we gelatin size,
mm-hmm.
you know, after a sheet of paper that's already been pressed and dried and flattened and whatever is then hand dipped in a tub of warm gelatin, it has to be repressed mm-hmm. and re-dried. And when it's dried, it has to be hung separately and individually in a loft. And so all of the watercolor paper is loft dried at the farm.
Okay.
And now that's the only thing that that building is used for.
That happens over there.
Right. Uh-huh. It's all that happens over there. And it's really important. It's really important to have that space.
So you're still volunteering at Twin Rocker to some degree, Catherine.
Yeah, now. Yeah. And how he fixes it.
You fix things.
He does maintenance.
They say I'm advantage it. I can swear at the guy that designed it.
And built it. He just completely rebuilt the beater you were talking about after 35 years.
Right.
They've had a major rebuild. Right. And Howie did, you know, Howie and Travis, I guess, but mostly yeah. Howie, you know, did all of it.
Right. Well, let's end with one story about an artist collaboration, because I know you've had artists come in to...
Oh, coming here again? You're thinking of coming here? Robert Kushner. And he came with all kinds of sequins and cloth, and he brought...
he'd been a set designer.
He happened to bring with him some... off sheets or something, some proofs from a lithograph that he had done, and it was a head of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very flamboyant, you know, mm-hmm. it's a black and white print of uh-huh. this head of a woman. And he has about 5 or 6 copies mm-hmm. of it. And so he's making these unique pieces that we're going to ship back to New York when they're dry.
Yeah.
And he happened to come here when my twin sister and I were having our birthday. He made a birthday present for me.
Mm-hmm.
He took 2 of those prints of the lady figure, uh-huh. the head, and put them side by side. And of course, they're exactly alike because uh-huh. it's an addition of a print.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then he finished the piece, you know, and did colored pulps and embedding and all this stuff with all these other things, and it's his scream, and so he's like, it's the twins. And so, yeah, that was a birthday present.
Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm sure my listeners will enjoy learning all about Twin Rocker. After the interview, Catherine showed me some of the work in their collection, and we talked about the publishing process in relation to a particular piece that was published by ULAE, featuring poetry by Alain Robbe-Grillet and artwork by Robert Rauschenberg. Here's that conversation, and you'll find a couple of photos of the piece, plus a video of Howard singing the Biederman's Blues, which he wrote and composed for the banjo, in the show notes at helenhebertstudio.com/products/series/paper-talk. That's a mouthful. Thanks for listening.
The role of a publisher. This is one of the big panels we had in the retrospective exhibit about Twin Rocker, because most people don't understand when a limited edition book happens or a limited edition print, what a publisher is.
Mm-hmm.
They think of the artist or the writer or something, if it's a book. But,
right, but there's
they don't
so much
think,
behind the scenes.
They don't think about, you know, how it gets to the marketplace.
Right.
So a publisher is an entity or a person who has the money.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the producer, in a sense.
Right.
And if it was a movie, it would be the producer.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the person who has the money. They can then take control completely and
be the artist, the writer themselves, and produce the thing, or they can hire a different artist, right, or a different writer.
Mm-hmm.
They can hire printers, they can hire bookbinders, they can hire paper makers, or they can do all of that themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of Tanya Grossman and Universal Limited Art Editions, of which we really must say, you know, this is past tense and she's been dead for quite a few years now.
Yeah.
But, so this is probably 1973 that we did this project. And it's a collaboration between Robert Rauschenberg and Robe Grier, Alain Robe Grier. So Tanya Grossman chose Robert Rauschenberg to be the visual artist, and she chose Robe Grier to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike publishers of books, usually, they would read manuscripts that were written, already written by authors, and they would choose a manuscript that already existed. Tanya Grossman, this is one of the reasons with Flood, it was influential to me, is that she wanted to create a dialogue between a writer and an artist.
Right.
And they did not know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he's in France. And okay. He's in the United right. States.
So, and often on a trade publication, the text, an illustrator is just chosen.
That's right. The text exists already, yeah, and the illustrator is chosen to right. illustrate it. And the text is not going to be changed one word.
Right.
You know, not
right.
one word, because right. it's got a copyright already. And so the illustrator is always sort of second fiddle,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
they're, the writing doesn't have anything to do with what mm-hmm. they're doing. Okay, so this is called Traces Suspect en Surface.
Mm-hmm.
And she, book is exchange with image and text.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. So one page would get, they have no idea what's going to happen in this book.
Mm-hmm.
One page is created by Rauschenberg, and then the next page is created by Robe Grier. And they don't know where it's going.
Is this signed? See that in white says Rauschenberg, I think. It's a watermark. There's a watermark.
It's a watermark. Okay. Okay, so that's the title. So we don't have the book.
And so how do you come into this?
We made the right. paper. Okay. So this is also big paper for very early.
So who decided the size?
They did. She did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
They're printers. Bill Goldstone probably did.
Right.
So this is the title page.
Mm-hmm.
And so they gave us none of the pages that are sellable. So they intentionally gave us the pages that are, in a sense, not sellable, all of the others.
You mean the pages you have in this portfolio
right,
here?
Exactly.
Okay. This was pages. A bigger book. There's more pages.
Yeah, the whole
and it's
that
bound
book is not here.
And, yeah.
No, it's not bound.
It's an unbound.
It was probably in a
bigger
beautiful
portfolio.
Yeah, mm-hmm. slipcase or something.
Okay.
I mean, a Dropbox.
Okay.
So this is a title page, and we can only do the others. So what happened in this drama?
Mm-hmm.
This thing became a drama. I, as far as I can remember, I think, that all the writing, when Robe Grier wrote something, it was nevertheless in Robert Rauschenberg's handwriting, because he was at ULAE. Robe Grier was in France.
Right.
So they would send something somehow across the ocean. And then the next page would be created by Rauschenberg.
Mm-hmm.
As the book progressed, they became irritated with each other.
Mm.
And one would say, well, I want two pages. And the other one said, well, you know, you don't get two pages. And it was like, well, if he's going to get that page, then I want to be able to choose the colors it's going to be printed, you know, the text. I want to be able to choose the colors it's printed in.
Mm-hmm.
And then this whole thing developed So I wish, you know, it's probably at the Museum of Modern Art. This is probably there. I mean, sometimes I really want to go see it.
Yeah.
Because the way it all developed, that there was this little war going on between the two across the ocean.
Right.
And so in the end, so we don't have the text, you know, we don't have the whole center of the book. But this is at the end of the printing of any limited edition print, the stones get effaced or something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they show, you know, they'll print one that shows that they marked out the stones. They can't be printed anymore.
Right.
And so this image, which is really nice. So, you know, Rauschenberg is seeing this as art, right?
Yeah.
And stones effaced, plates canceled. And then, so it was just so much fun to get these sort of these pages that are not sellable, quote, you know, the unimportant pages that which are so great.
Right.
So this one, a couple of stones they printed one on top of the other. Bill Goldston, garage manager, who, because it's famous that Universal Limited Art Editions happens in this tiny house that Tanya and her husband found, and they printed in the garage.
Okay.
And so that's where the presses are, in the garage. Uh-huh. So Bill Goldston, who's her right-hand man, is the garage manager, printed John Lund, who was a printer, and James Smith. Those are the two printers, along with Bill Goldston, who's also a printer. So they get credit on this page. So in a sense, it's like the colophon.
Right.
Here is the colophon, however.
Okay.
So the colophon is 172 to 178. That's how many years it took to do.
Oh, my gosh.
So this is another thing. All these legends. This is one of the very first papers we made for Tanya. Mm-hmm. And I had already heard all these legends about her, about how she would wait for years to get the right papers, search the world over. And then we end up, and this Leaf Deluxe is taking 6 years to make. Mm-hmm. 36 in the edition, 6 artist proofs, 3 paper maker,
pages?
I don't know.
Plus
PP,
one.
This could be paper maker's proof, but
okay,
it's not. Not because we don't have an we don't have one of them. 31 pages plus title page plus 4 colophon page embossed. I don't know what that means.
Right.
Something publisher's
oh,
seal.
Near the publisher's seal.
This is the publisher's seal.
Not there.
That doesn't mean and. Colophon.
Number, maybe?
Numbered page, embossed.
Yeah.
I don't know. 37 stones, 27 plates, paper 27 by folded, made by Twin Rocker, watermarked with artist and author's
signature.
Okay, so there must be both of them in here.
Let me see if that.
So there's Berg here. We can probably get it better.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Okay, well, then there's Rogue Gray must be in here, too.
Oh, yeah, I see it.
Do you see it?
Right here.
Oh, okay. We'll lift that up. You can see. I haven't seen this in actually years either. Oh, yeah, I remember this.
Oh, yeah, let's see. Perfect.
So this was really, I mean, I just think is a collaboration and a story that goes with it. It's really a fun.
Yeah, it's
fun
beautiful.
Thing. And, of course, we loved getting these valueless pages.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list, to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.